You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician, and I can't believe that it's close to 400 episodes and I have never ever talked about gene therapy. Maybe that's because I personally never really got involved in that space. I wasn't working in at any of the biotech companies that are heavily involved in it and wasn't cooperating on this. And of course, most of my career, I worked in the very late stages, so kind of post-approval. And well, that also doesn't help if you work on these kind of very, very new and innovative therapies. And for that, I have two awesome guests here on the show, and you will learn throughout this podcast why these are great guests to have on the show for this topic. So Avery and Alex. So maybe you can start introducing yourself. Avery, do you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you so much, Alexander. So I'm Avery McIntosh. I'm a statistician based in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. I work for Pfizer, and I currently work in our internal medicine division, where we have a number of compounds in hematology and metabolic disorders, cardiovascular. I met Alex actually working at Novartis. When I first came out of graduate school, I was hired into Novartis. And while at Novartis, we discovered the really interesting world of gene therapies and were able to work together on a number of projects. And some of those projects moved forward and some did not. But one of the ones that did move forward that I'm sure we'll talk about is this book that we recently developed on gene therapy drug development. So happy to speak about that and happy to be with you here today.
Cool. Alex, what about you?
Yeah, thank you for a nice intro. I'm Alex Sverdlov. I'm a statistician at Novartis. So I've been with Novartis for 8 years now, joined the company in 2016. And I'm working in the field of neuroscience and supporting the early stage of development, which involves the preclinical studies, the first in human studies, and proof of concept studies. And as Avery said, yeah, I was lucky to meet with him back in 2017. And then we worked together on a couple of projects, and it wasn't until 2021 when we decided to develop an edited volume, which is the scope of today's presentation. And yes, happy to talk more about it.
Awesome. Very good. So before we go a little bit more into the book, let's first talk about what actually is gene therapy.
All right, I can start there. And Alex, if I miss anything, please feel free to chime in. So gene therapy, you mentioned earlier, Alexander, that it's innovative and new. And I would say innovative, yes, but new, actually not so much. So these drugs have really been around, and the idea behind them has been around for a long time, really stretching back into the 20th century, when it was realized that some diseases are heritable and genetic in nature. But the pharmacologic science and the basic biology that it took to develop a drug and all of the elements that new drugs have to have to be safe and tolerable and to go through all of the regulatory exercises really didn't take shape until the 1990s. But from that time forward, there was a number of years where there was no approved therapies. And then in 2017 and 2018, there were a number of regulatory approvals. The first was for Kymriah, which is a cell therapy for relapsed refractory leukemia, acute lymphocytic leukemia. And then Zolgensma for spinal muscular atrophy and Luxturna, which is for a form of inherited retinal blindness. And since that time, there have now been, I think as of today, maybe 33 FDA approvals, and most of those are approved in EMA as well. So it's really accelerating quickly. And just a note on the mechanism of action, these drugs are, the term gene therapy is really a broad term to encompass any sort of drug that affects the expression of genetic information. So all of our cells have DNA, nucleic acids, and these are transcribed into RNA and then translated into proteins, which really powers all of the activities of our bodies and our cells. So gene therapy drugs correct or address some form of genetic disease. Some people may be born with a genetic disorder that prevents the appropriate expression of cell proteins and results in some sort of deficiency and downstream disease. And some examples that your listeners may have heard of are Huntington's disease, as I mentioned, spinal muscular atrophy, cystic fibrosis, and...
The target of action is from gene to DNA to RNA and from RNA to the proteins. Is it also directly targeting the gene itself, so changing the chromosomes?
Well, that sort of depends on the mechanism of action. So there's this broad label of gene therapies, but some of them transfer a therapeutic gene into the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And that gene exists in an episomal form, so like a circular DNA form that's then translated and transcribed every time the DNA is read in the cell. But there are other modalities, gene editing modalities, but many people have heard of CRISPR. That's been in the news a lot. Yeah. And those generally do impact the chromosomal DNA structure itself, theoretically, in a permanent manner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it really depends on the type. And as I mentioned, there's also those ex vivo cell therapies that some people call gene therapies, some people call cell therapies. They're kind of a fuzzy delineation there, where cells are transfused out of the body and then genetically engineered to express certain antigens that trigger the immune system to fight cancer and then are reinfused into the body. So those cells are engineered, but whether they're lifelong or last for a long duration, the way that so-called in vivo cell therapies might work is, I think, not clear.
Anything to
add? That also that, so just from the name, the gene therapy, so it affects the fundamental biology of our human body. And so we can think about these gene therapies as more like organ transplants instead of pharmacological modalities.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we either insert the missing gene or deactivate the deficient gene or do some other sort of editing of genetic information.
So if we actually change the gene itself, then and that is permanent. So then it's basically potentially a cure to the disease if we know exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, that's been a hot topic in the field, is what is the durability of these products? And, you know, as statisticians, this is something that falls on us ultimately.
Okay.
To adjudicate the durability of these products. And all gene therapies in major regulatory environments the patients who are administered a gene therapy have to be followed for 5 to 15 years after their initial dosing. And it's really an open question for different modalities, which ones of these are permanent and which ones of these are long lasting. You know, the initial targets for gene therapies were neurological indications because the neuron cells are generally non-dividing. So then you could introduce an episomal DNA structure and theoretically it wouldn't be diluted when cells divide. But since then, there's been a lot of work in this area. And now there's approved gene therapies for hemophilia that target the liver, right, which is rapidly dividing.
Yeah.
So that it really does depend on the disease and the nature of the gene therapy, the vector, and a lot of features as to whether these are curative or not.
Okay. But it's still a pretty interesting hope to have to cure some of these really debilitating diseases. So as we talk about gene therapy, are these all kind of rare diseases, orphan indications?
So I can start and we can pick up on that. So yes, the gene therapies are usually developed for rare diseases. And of course, there's no universal definition of the rare disease. In the United States, it's defined as a disease or condition that affects fewer than 200,000 people. And from this, one may imagine that the development of gene therapies would be more challenging compared to the more common diseases because the patient populations are limited when all sorts of restrictions apply. But this is not the only therapeutic area, so not limited to rare diseases. So we have more common diseases that have to do with heart failure or, for example, Alzheimer's disease, which is not as rare.
Yeah.
They really pick up on this.
Yeah. Okay. That's super interesting. So now, what are the specific challenges beyond, let's say, that it's a rare disease that make it harder for gene therapies to get approved? Or why is it actually different to, let's say, a typical drug? Avery?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I think it's more difficult, certainly partly because of that rare disease component that Alex was speaking of. There's also very high manufacturing standards and purity and chemistry manufacturing and control standards. And, you know, if you look into the news, there's been many clinical holds and pauses and even complete response letters from regulators wanting more information about the manufacturing and the purity and the potency of these products. So that's been a major bottleneck in terms of scaling up because creating research grade product has been generally feasible, but then creating enough products, meeting the same standards to treat an entire population has been a real burden. And there are a number of statisticians involved in the CMC space who work in this area, very brilliant statisticians. That's not something that myself or Alex have done, although we've maybe moonlighted a little bit. The small sample sizes is a challenge. And I'll say another one that I'm currently working on quite a bit is how you perform dose finding in these types of populations, because these patients, due to the immunogenetic nature of the therapies, really can only be treated one time. So it's a single administration, potentially lifelong, impactful treatment.
Okay.
And if a patient were to receive a subtherapeutic dose or a dose that was too high, one of two things could happen. So if it's too low, they may be precluded from receiving a gene therapy again in the future that has a similar vector because their immune system's been triggered. And then if that gene therapy is administered again or at a higher dose or a similar gene therapy, their immune system could target that gene therapy and recognize it or create an overactive immune response. And if the dose is too high, you know, we're usually trying to get these proteins expression to some sort of therapeutic window, similar to non-gene therapy drugs, then that gene therapy is not going to wash out and not going to be cleared by the liver and the kidneys the same way that a small molecule or a biologic might. And so that upregulation, quote unquote, overdose could be potentially permanent. And so we do have a lot of statistical tools for dose finding in non-gene therapy settings. And these have really been developed mostly in the context of oncology. There's been just brilliant work done over the past 10, 15 years in Bayesian models. But applying that in the gene therapy space is a little bit tricky because most of these compounds usually only have two, maximum three dose levels under study. And so for models like Bayesian logistic regression, which is very commonly used in oncology trials, it's a Bayesian model. And so you have a prior probability distribution. But if you only have two doses and you have a small number of patients before you expand and choose your target dose to enroll more patients, then that type of model will really be much more dependent on the prior probability. In a sense, the prior almost dictates your decisions.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's some of the other challenges.
Yeah, and I would also add to that, there are also some ethical challenges that stem from that. We have patients who are very ill, right? So they have genetic disorders, and potentially these are pediatric patients. So pediatric patients, their central nervous system is still forming, and when introducing the gene therapy, will have a profound impact on their body and the entire system organ. So that means that we have to be very mindful about not just statistical aspects, how we do dose finding, sample size justification, but also keeping in mind these restrictions related to the ethical considerations. And in later phase clinical trials, for example, there may be ethical challenge the use of placebo group. So it would be really unethical to do some sham injection and deprive the patient from the opportunity to receive gene therapy, especially if it's a very severe disease. So all sorts of things arise.
Okay. In terms of that, these later challenges in terms of randomized studies and things like that. So, well, the not to use placebo is not a new kind of argument. In lots of areas, especially, you know, oncology or other life-threatening diseases, people say, well, you can't use placebo. However, then, of course, the kind of, it's very hard on the safety profile to understand what's really going on. And of course, you don't really know whether the new treatment will actually help. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a conundrum. Yeah. You need to run the study to know that it was unethical to use placebo. So at the time you make the decision to run a confirmatory study, you actually don't know. So it's kind of, you know, a little bit like, you know, the famous cat in the box where you don't know whether it's dead or alive.
Exactly. That's almost like a catch-22, yes, because we are facing a problem of clinical research versus clinical practice. Yeah. Because that ideally we would certainly like to have participants who are exposed to these new treatments, they would like to provide them with most benefit so that they derive the opportunity and not miss the treatment that's efficacious in the trial. However, when we run the trial, we don't really know which one is efficacious, which one may be unsafe. So it's a leap of faith to a large extent for these patients who volunteer to participate. And so there are ethical challenges also related to the informed consent, how patients actually consent to take part in such experiments, especially when it comes to pediatric patients. So there are obviously obligations for their parents to rule, basically sign the informed consent. So that really speaks to the importance of all these medical ethics questions that have to be cleared. And also the health authorities would have to really authorize and give the permission to run these experiments.
Mm. Is there anything else that makes it different to, let's say, the typical pharmacological interventions that we study and get approved?
Well, just back to the placebo topic again, beyond being, you know, potentially unethical, it may actually be infeasible because you used, Alexander, the word curative earlier. And a lot of people do have that connotation around gene therapies. They think that it's almost like a miracle cure, right? And of course, that's not true. There are many investigational gene therapies that fail. just like every other kind of drug. But there is some information that we might have with gene therapies that we might not have with other types of diseases or drugs that we would work in. And that's a very well-defined target. Mm-hmm. So unlike any sort of complex disease, heart failure or Alzheimer's, where genes may be implicated in a person's risk, you know, it's not like Mendelian, where if you have the gene, the variants, you will be effective. So there's some very good animal models that have been developed and used for many types of gene therapies that are studied in these animals. And then if there's adequate rescue in the animal species, then they would have a lot of faith that these would be advantageous and efficacious and usually safe for human populations. Now, there's always an asterisk around that because, you know, the translatability of these is quite tricky. But historically, it's been the case that FDA, not very, let's say, a little bit more skeptical of the use of historical data or synthetic data for placebo arms. And that's not done unless the disease under study is very severe. Well, it so happens that for many gene therapies, the disease is extremely severe. And so there's probably more use of historical data in the gene therapy space than in other spaces. But there's certainly, as you mentioned, plenty of cases where regulators and sponsors will say, we need a placebo-controlled trial. So just finding that balance is a bit tricky. And then exploring all of the statistical methods that we might have, it's a vast space, actually, of how you can run single-arm trials or trials with historical controls or with Bayesian augmented control designs and all sorts of new techniques for that. So that in and of itself could certainly be a topic for your podcast.
Yeah. Well, these topics are ongoing on my podcast. Historical controls is definitely a hot topic for quite some time. Single-arm trials or trials that don't have a one-to-one randomization, but maybe a 1-to-5 or whatever randomization, is definitely a really, really important one. Now, if we think about gene therapies, and one, is there the potential that you would have such huge effects that kind of you can actually get around a placebo just because of that?
Yeah, I can give a very concrete example of that. So I believe it was either the second or third. They all came in quick succession. The drug Zolgensma, the technical name, let's see if I can get this, is omecamtiv mecarbil. It's a hard name to say. That drug was studied initially in children with a really devastating disease called spinal muscular atrophy, where for the patients who have the most severe form of the disease, which is type 1 SMA, the survival beyond 2 years of age is essentially zero. And that was gained from natural history data. And when the drug was administered to these children, essentially all of them, I think there might have been one death, but all of the children lived past 2 years of age. So that right there, you don't necessarily have to be a statistician. And someone I was working with at the time previously said, oh, why do you want to work in gene therapies? You know, it's going to be very easy. It's going to be not challenging at all. And then every other program that I worked in gene therapies was tremendously challenging, because the reality is you may have movement on some neurological scale, and those are always very challenging, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of variability there. You may have a situation where the patient population is extremely rare, right? You may only have 50 or 100 patients, and that's a really unique situation to develop a drug in. Or you may have regulatory guidance that is from a number of years previous, and so then you may be bound to that guidance, right? So there's a lot of challenges in real life, and I think that drug in particular, a lot of people looked at it and got extremely excited about gene therapies as a class of drugs. But then, you know, reality set in that, of course, it's not always going to be like this. Of course, this target and this disease was chosen because of the strong therapeutic hypothesis and the ability to potentially rescue. So they certainly picked the right disease to start with. But then all of the other diseases that we've studied have been quite complex.
Yeah. So, and I guess these first really huge successes have also shaped how the general public is looking at gene therapy. What's your take on that?
Yeah, sure. I think there are various implications. First of all, as I already mentioned, so it's easy to be, or well, it's good to be first successful drug. Then later on, I think health authorities will increase the bar and make it more difficult to pass. So there will be more scrutiny for the drugs that will follow, because they will have to demonstrate that they're at least as good as the existing drug. And obviously, the level of evidence will have to be higher in subsequent trials and subsequent submissions to get marketing authorization. But that also implies that there are tremendous opportunities, just not tied to a particular indication, but it can be related to a class of drug and class of treatment modalities. If we take as an example the CAR T cell therapies, or following Kymriah approval, there are so many different investigational CAR T cell therapies for various indications, just going beyond the hematologic malignancies. And that certainly means that approvals like this, they form the basis for future innovation and development of additional drugs.
Yeah. What do people that you talk to, you know, outside of a pharma, what do they tell you if you say you work on gene therapy?
Well, I think that most people have heard of CRISPR in the news, right? Yeah. And so people have some basic familiarity with it, but I think there's a conception that gene therapies it's kind of the same, it's conflated with the term genetic engineering.
Yeah.
Which is quite different. And how these are different is you might have, I'm just making this up, genetically engineered tomatoes or something where, you know, any seeds from that tomato are also genetically engineered, and maybe they're purple or green tomatoes or something. But for human gene therapy, all of the drugs go through testing to ensure that they do not affect the germline. So they're what we call somatic, meaning they only affect cells that have nothing to do with reproduction. So if a person receives a gene therapy treatment for a disease, any future children they may have should be totally unaffected from that person taking the gene therapy drug. And besides that misconception, I think people are very excited about it, people I've spoken with, just because of the potential to really cure, or I should say at least treat, very severe diseases. You know, Alex mentioned this, at least 200,000 persons in the U.S. Well, there's rare diseases are by definition rare, but there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And,
you know, rare diseases are not rare.
Yeah. They're actually common, you know, in aggregate, right? And so many people know someone who may be affected, or a family member who may be affected by a rare disease. So there's been a lot of enthusiasm, which is great to hear.
Yeah. Cool. So when you want to start a career in that space, you know, what would you recommend to a person kind of learning?
Excellent question. It really depends on the background and where the person wants to work. So I think we have a nice chapter in the book that talks about development of gene therapies from academic perspective, and that is quite, I would say, different from the pharmaceutical industry perspective, where we have, of course, more resources, but also bigger teams of drug developers that are tasked with various day-to-day job activities related to these clinical development programs. And so if someone like me would consider joining drug development and step into the field of gene therapy. So I'm a statistician by training. So I had courses in biostatistics. I don't have a formal degree in biology, which I think it would be a nice synergy to have in addition to my background in mathematics and statistics. But certainly any graduate level work or any undergraduate work that the person completes is extremely helpful. Then obviously some background in genetics would help a lot, and some background in drug development would help. Drug development experience comes just by doing day-to-day job and being involved into the project. And then this is definitely a team work where we have a clinical team of people with various backgrounds. Some of them may be statisticians, but of course there are medical doctors and clinical scientists and clinical pharmacologists, clinical safety leads. So it's an amazing experience that both Favor and I had during our time at Novartis. So I continue enjoying interacting with many of the team members. And in fact, if you look at the content of the book, then it's not so clear from the beginning. But when we started it, probably 80% of the people were from Novartis, but because of various job changes and life doesn't stop. So we have very diverse group of people who contributed to the volume. So they're all across the industry and across the globe now.
Can you tell me a little bit more about who should read this book?
Sure. So I'm glad that you brought that up, Alexander. So we had initially thought that we might have a book that was purely for biostatisticians. But as we got further into it, we realized, this is such a broad topic. And there's literature. If you search around, you will find literature on different topics, but certainly nothing together in one place like this, where if you're interested in the development of these drugs, let's say that you're working for a pharmaceutical sponsor, and you want to know more about gene therapies, and maybe you're in the regulatory space and you might have some domain knowledge there, but you don't have so much domain knowledge in the scientific development, the preclinical development, the clinical trial design and analysis considerations, or any of the history of the gene therapies, then this book would certainly help with those types of things. And we also envisioned that it would be really helpful for family members of people who may be affected by a genetic disease and who are considering pursuing a gene therapy treatment, as well really as the business community. A lot of gene therapies are developed through spin-offs of academic labs or academic licensing and are then funded through venture capitalism. So if a person is an investor and is curious about investing in a gene therapy startup or a biotech that's working in this space, and they want to understand a little bit more about the development process, how long does it take, what types of expertise are essential, what's scientifically the best practice, then they would reach for this book as well.
Yeah, and we should not forget also the academic community. So our hope is that some of these chapters may form the basis for graduate level course and maybe actually inspire future generation of scientists to work on some challenging problems like this.
That is awesome. That is really awesome. Now, there's one additional thing I want to tap into. I'm always intrigued when people actually publish a book, because I think it's on the bucket list of many people to write a book, and maybe lots of people even start a book, but actually getting it through the publishing line is a complete different thing. So what was your experience in working on this book? And it's a book that has, lots of contributed chapters. So you're not the only authors on the book, but kind of editing this book, putting it together, working with all the different authors, working with the publisher, all these kind of different things. What was your experience?
Maybe I'll let Alex start off, because he's done this before. This was my first rodeo.
So okay, I can start and then I'll pass it on to you. So yes, I have done some publishing work previously. We chose this publisher because I have some good history with it. And I edited two volumes and co-authored another book with this publisher. And so the idea came to us to develop another one in 2021. And it took us 3 years in total to drive it from the ideation to publication. So we chose this format of edited volume for a reason, because for such a complex subject, it's really difficult to do it by yourself, because no one knows everything, and so it requires really diverse expertise from drug developers and from academic people, and we even have some people from the health authorities also among the contributors to this chapter. And I think overall it was a fascinating experience. So we learned a lot, and we actually had an opportunity to grow our networks and interact with really brilliant scientists, as well as with the publishing team. Then I personally learned how to use Overleaf. That's a typing editing system. That's sort of that's the standard for books like this. And it was learning experience, tremendous learning experience, which I highly recommend to anyone who wants to or just do something really cool.
And Avery, for you, for your first rodeo, how was that?
Yeah. So I it's funny, when we initially got together and pitched this idea to our publisher, CRC Press, I thought, okay, we have a lot of this mapped out. We'll have this done inside of a year, right? I set an ambitious goal. And of course, life happens and people move and people change jobs. And, I moved twice and me and my wife had a baby. And so many things happened. And through that process, keeping it going was something that we really focused on. We didn't want ourselves or the contributors to lose steam, because people are really dedicating their nights and weekends to this. And so making it we had regular group emails that we would send out, just letting people know, okay, here's the progress, here's some sample chapters that have been completed, and allowing people to do any peer review of other people's chapters if they wanted to. And it was also a diverse experience receiving finished chapters, because some of the people we worked with, it was very collaborative, and we were there from the very beginning with all of the ideas and the structure, and then helped edit it and maybe would suggest rewrites of certain sections. And there were other people who were like working off by themselves, and then we just got an email and they said, here it is. And it was in excellent shape, I should say, so it's very nice when that happens too. Both of them are, like Alex said, are really beneficial, and there's such an opportunity to learn and to really collaborate with people in biostatistics and in maybe our partner, cousin, quantitative lines like clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics, but also with people that I might not normally interact with very much. We have a chapter in this book on immunology, which to me was a real blind spot for me in my own education. And I learned so much just reviewing this chapter and working with its really talented author, Matthew Marigioli. So I would recommend anybody who is interested in continuing to grow their career and grow their professional development, their network, and really make some friends along the way. But it's a great thing if you can get the right publishing support and you have an idea where you think you can develop a book from those ideas. Yeah, by all means, it's a great enterprise.
Yeah, and I completely agree. It always takes longer than you anticipate, because you never kind of acknowledge all the unknown unknowns. Yeah, so your first baby is such a big thing. It completely shifts lots of things. Yeah. Changes in career, all these kind of different things. And of course, if that even happens for multiple authors, then it's a completely different area of complexity.
Yeah.
Still, thanks so much for putting this together. Of course, you will find all these kind of different things in the show notes. So you can just go to the Effective Statistician and send search for Avery and Alex, and you'll easily find that book about gene therapy that Bose wrote. So any last advice you would like to give to a listener? And remember, these are mostly statisticians and data scientists listening here.
Well, I would just give the piece of advice to not be too afraid to step out of your comfort zone, right? We all as statisticians have what we consider to be our area of expertise and our area of competency. And when I was recruited into work on these drugs, and maybe it was 2019, I flew out to San Diego to meet with some clinical colleagues from AveXis, which was just being acquired by Novartis at that time. And they really pushed me to be innovative and to, you know, the, think outside the box and think of new clinical designs and really push the envelope for how we could work within regulatory restrictions to get these drugs to patients as fast as possible, because the unmet medical need is just huge with the diseases that gene therapies can treat. So that was a little bit uncomfortable for me to really jump out and dive into new designs and new statistical methods that I was less familiar with. But it was such a benefit. You know, I benefited as a statistician and as a partner drug developer. So I would just say to continue on in your professional education and never be afraid to learn something new, even if it's a little bit scary.
I love that. Well, growth always happens outside of your comfort zone. So
yeah.
I'd like to add to that, actually. I think that that's an excellent point, that it remains stepping on your comfort zone. And actually, statisticians have tremendous potential. So I think it's just we need to be more confident, and just experience shows that the medical leads and other stakeholders, they're so much appreciative of the work that we're doing. And we just need to make sure that we stay visible and we articulate clearly all that we do and do efficient presentations. And then it becomes a very rewarding experience. Mm-hmm. So be just confident in yourself.
Yeah, I love that. Be more confident. I could tell that to lots of people. There's the generally, and I think in our community, a lack of confidence, and a little bit more confidence can definitely help. Thanks so much for this great discussion about gene therapy.
Thank you, Alexander. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.